Hey everybody, welcome back. This is the last module before we're going to take a meal break. So at the end of this one, we'll take a meal break. We'll break for about an hour or so, give you a good time to go sit down and stop playing with DocumentDB. Yeah, you can always eat later, that's fine. So last session, we're going to take a look at developing solutions with DocumentDB, and we're going to look at sharding, right? So we've already said that, you know, we've covered off a brief introduction, some management, some queries, some optimizations. Let's take a look at kind of another fundamental thing that you need to think about when you're building applications on any kind of scale-out database, not just Azure DocumentDB, but any kind of database where you want to scale out indefinitely. So in this module, we're going to kind of have a look at three major things, right? What is a collection, in case you're still unclear about what a collection means in DocumentDB. We're going to look at different ways to partition your data, and there's lots and lots of different ways. Sometimes it's easy to pick one of these. Sometimes you can't pick one of these. You have your own kind of custom need, and that's okay. But we'll talk about some common practices, and then we'll talk about fan-out queries and what they mean and that kind of stuff. So, prizes to kind of people on what is a collection. So, Arvind, what is a collection in terms of DocumentDB?
Collection is a partition.
Collection is a partition. Say it with me, everybody. Collection is a partition. All right, so, you know, we're saying that over and over again because, you know, it's not like a collection or a table in SQL Server where I can only store customer entities or order entities. I can store different things. And the way you think about what should go into a collection is more on how you transact with that, right? So if I'm going to be writing a multi-tenanted solution, all the documents related to that tenant or that user or this device in an IoT world or whatever, the things that I'm going to write together, read together, display on my app together, those are the things that you need to think about to put in a collection together, okay? So, you know, don't just kind of create collections and put orders here and customers there, but kind of put them together in one collection. And we'll talk now about how do you take these and kind of spread your application across these shards, right? So a collection gives you two things. One, it gives you a size, a capacity, so it's 10 gigabytes, okay? And it gives you a set amount of throughput depending on what size collection you've bought. So if you have more than 10 gigabytes of storage in your database, you have to scale across collections. If you need more than 2,500 request units per second, you need to scale across collections, and you need to distribute your load across those collections. And you can scale, I mean, you can shard for other reasons as well, but those are the two major reasons that you have to shard across collections. So let's take a look at kind of some of the common practices for partitioning data, right? How do you go about partitioning data? It's like modeling your data. It gets easier with practice. The more you do it, the easier it becomes. But there's some common patterns that we'll take a look at now. The first one, and this one plays really well to that, the notion of I'm sitting in the basement of my mother's house, and you know I am drinking Red Bull and eating pizzas and doing nothing else for the day, but I'm putting out my cool application, right? And I have no idea whether this application is going to be the next, the next game of the century that you know kids all around the world play or whatever. I have no idea whether it's going to be the next big thing or the next big bust, right? But what I do know is that I want to quickly get this app out there. I want to quickly kind of start with it, and as this app becomes more successful, I then want to just have my application grow. I don't want to be kind of contained, right?
And that's the what they call the fear of success, right?
The fear of success, indeed. Yeah, you know, sometimes the fear of success is actually more than the fear of failure, because you know I can build the app, and it kind of gets, you know, Reddited or Slashdotted or whatever the cool kids today use, and suddenly billions of people around the world are using my game, and now I need to kind of scale to kind of keep up. And that's one of the cool promises of the cloud, is that, you know, I can just deploy it, and as it becomes popular, I can just kind of turn up the dial and I can just grow, right? And the flip side to that is also important. You know, I don't want to have to go out and phone up my computer supplier and say, hey, you know what, I need about 1,000 servers up front, and I need this amount of space to kind of host them and run them, and because I think I'm going to be the next, you know, big thing. And guess what? I put it out there, and people hate it, and it's not the next best thing. And now I have 1,000 servers sitting in my mother's basement, heating the house, and that's about all I can do with them. So, you know, the cloud offers you the ability to have the opposite of scale fast, and that's die fast as well, right? I can put an app out there with little to no startup costs, all right? And if the thing's successful, great, I can scale with it. And if it's not successful, okay, I tear it down and it's cost me a cup of coffee or whatever it has cost me to run the thing. Okay.
Yeah, the gaming industry is in reverse, right? I mean, where the day of the launch, you need all the servers you need to handle the workload, and then you taper off, and then absolutely. While you prepare for the next version of your game.
And then you kind of prepare the next version of the game, and then you go through the same cycle again. So one of the cool kind of ways to start off with this is because I might not know how many partitions I need, right? I'd love to kind of start off and say, oh, I'm going to need 20,000 DocumentDB collections up front. But I don't really know that. And it would be silly of me. I'd love it if you did, because it means more money for me. But it would be silly of you to kind of go up in day one and provision 20,000 DocumentDB collections and then hope that you're going to use them. All right. So one way that you can start off with is start off with one collection. All right. Start off, grab yourself an S3 or an S2 even, because you can always scale them up as you go. So start off with an S2. Gives you a nice kind of throughput, gives you 10 gig of storage, reasonable amount of throughput. So start off with an S2. If it becomes popular, scale it up to an S3, okay? Gives you a bit more workload. And then what you want to do is you want to start filling that thing up, all right? And you don't want to wait until you've got to 100% full of your collection and then panic and go, oh, I've run out of space, what do I do? Because then your life becomes hell, okay? Because we're going to throttle you because you're trying to fill up a collection that's already too full, and you're going to get throttled while you're trying to move data into a new collection, and it's just going to be a nightmare situation. So what you want to do is you want to set yourself some kind of a headroom, right? About 80%, 75%, 80%, depending on your documents, depending on how quickly you're writing documents, that kind of stuff. Set yourself a nice headroom, okay? When your collection gets to that size headroom, create yourself another collection and now start filling that one up, right? And then what you do is you then fill that one up. When that one gets to a particular space, again, around about the headroom size, then what you do is you create another one, spill over into that one, right? And as your application grows, you just kind of start spreading it over more and more and more collections. But you start off really simple and you kind of grow, right? And also, it's also important to know that picking this partitioning strategy up front doesn't mean that this is going to be your partitioning strategy forever, right? You can always then switch to a different strategy later. You'll have to do a little bit of work about rebalancing and moving some data between your partitions, but you're not stuck to spillover for forever, right? So you can start off with this one, fairly low risk, get going really quickly, and then grow as you need to. The next one that's really important and quite popular is this notion of partitioning by range. So some kind of a range, right? The range could be by date range, okay? So all data for this week goes into one collection, all data for next week goes into another collection, okay? It could be by hour, by minute, by day, by whatever. So some kind of a date range. It could also be by, zip code. You mentioned zip code, right? So all data coming from 98052, which is the Redmond zip code, goes into this collection. Zip code or all data coming from a different zip code goes into a different collection. Okay, so you can have ranges by different things. It doesn't only have to be date. You can create a range on almost anything you like, right? You could say, hey, whatever you wanted. But date range works really, really nicely for data. And especially what you can do here is you can keep the data that you're using all the time. So the current data that's being written and being queried, keep that hot. And what I mean by keep that hot is that put that in an S3 collection, right? Because that's where your throughput's going to be, right? And then what happens is you use that one, and over time, what ends up happening is you start, you know, your data ages out, okay? And as your data ages out, what you do is you start scaling down the old collections, right? You don't need the data from 6 months ago that gets queried once every now and then and it never gets written to anymore. You don't need that to be an S3 collection anymore, right? You can happily scale that down to an S1, pay $25 a month for it rather than $100 a month for it, all right? But then as your data kind of stays current, what you do is you keep that one as an S3 and the collection just behind the range, make that an S2 and then phase out your other ones as an S1. And then at some point, once you want to get the data out of your system, you have some kind of an archiving policy that takes your S1s and, I don't know, archives them to blob storage or something like that, or just deletes them, whatever you want. So partitioning data by range is a fairly common thing that we see happening quite often. This one happens fairly often when we see a use case of people using DocumentDB to do logging of events or logging of information, some kind of time series-based data. Another one that we see a lot, and this is where it's a more multi-tenanted system. So if I was a software as a service provider and I was building, I don't know, an application that I sold to tenants, right? So it's a multi-tenanted software as a service. So you sign up and you become Contoso Inc. and someone else signs up and they become Litware Inc. and they have users and Litware Inc. has users. You want to be able to keep all of that tenant's data together somewhere. All right, now how do you do it? Some people kind of say, well, I want a collection per tenant. Now, the problem with collection per tenant is, well, our collections are 10 gig in size. Okay, they have throughput of 250 request units per second for the smallest one, and they cost you $25 a month for the smallest one. So if you went with a collection per tenant, okay, every time you sign up a new tenant, it's at the minimum is gonna cost you $25 a month every time you sign that up, right? And unless that's a really big tenant that's producing lots and lots and lots of data, you're gonna have a collection that's nowhere near its capacity, right? Unless that single tenant is gonna store 10 gigs worth of data. So you're actually better off putting multiple tenants together inside of a collection. And this is where partitioning by lookup works really nicely. So I can actually say, hey, this customer is in tenant or in partition one, this customer's in partition one, this customer's in partition one, this customer's a very important customer of mine, and I'm gonna put him on his own in a separate collection, and I'm gonna jack up the performance of that one. This customer here, and you know, some new customers, I'm gonna put them in that one. And what you can actually do is these can grow over time as well. So, you know, I can start off by saying, I'm gonna put all of my customers into the first collection, right? And then at some point I say, oh no, that one's kind of filling up. So my headroom thing, this time I'm gonna go to about 50% of my collection. All right, I've passed 50%, I'm gonna create a new collection, and now any new users get assigned to the new collection and all their data stays in that collection. And then you just keep adding to this lookup. And what you effectively have is you have some kind of a master lookup somewhere, right? And it can be some kind of a shard map that says, hey, this tenant, if you're partitioning by tenant, the example I'm using here, this tenant is in this partition, this tenant is in that partition, this tenant's in that partition. And if at some point a tenant becomes a high important customer and you want him to be in a separate partition, you can then create a new shard map entry, move him to the new partition, and then move the data from the old one to the new one, and then that tenant's isolated all on their own. Okay. So there's lots of different ways that you can deal with this. You can also use partition lookups for, I don't know, whatever you wanted. If you had devices that were emitting logs that were in a facility, right? I could say facility A, B, and C are in this collection, facility D, E, and F are in that collection, facility X, Y, Z are in that collection, and that's how I can kind of do things. So it's got some notion of things are mapped to a collection, and there's a mapping file somewhere that my application looks up, probably caches it somewhere so that I don't have to keep asking for that map, caches it somewhere locally in the application in memory, and then you know serves that. And I've got a quick demo of using some custom code that I wrote that does some lookup partitioning. So let's jump to that quickly, and let me show you what that looks like. So if we go into here, we'll make this code available online for download afterwards. So don't stress if you don't get access to this right now, but just follow along. It's fairly simple what I've done. I've got a structure-wise, I've got a data project, I've got a model project, and in here I've just kind of got a simple model which has got a description and it's got a type, okay? And it extends from a base, and the base has got a tenant ID on it, okay? So this is a simple, hey, every document is gonna have a tenant ID on it, and I'm actually gonna be sharding by tenant ID in this case, right? And I see this is not, let me just rebuild this project quickly, so hopefully, yep, there you go, it's downloading the latest NuGet projects, okay, and that's why I have references here that aren't fixed.
1.0.
1.0. So this is the first taste of the official GA SDK. If you've been using DocumentDB before, you'll know the NuGet package has been 0.9.2 preview. This is the 1.0 SDK. So if I go along now, you'll see that those little red lines are actually now gone. It knows what a resource is. Okay. So that's my simple model. Really nothing complicated there. I wanted to kind of keep it simple. In here, I've got the notion of a repository, right? So I'm kind of using a repository pattern. Every repository has some basic stuff you can actually create and you can find. That's a really, really simple repository. Again, I wanted to make sure that I kind of kept this simple. And then there's a DocumentDB repository. So every repository I'm going to create extends from this one. And this one's just got some kind of common code in how to do a generic find operation. So if you have a look, this one just takes in a generic type. It takes in some expression over there, a predicate expression, and it executes that predicate expression. And then you'll see the same thing. So get of a particular type takes in a collection link and a document ID, and it executes a collection. So it's very, very generic code, but this is like, you know, simple DocumentDB code. And then what you'll see will happen is I have an item repository. Okay, so an item repository implements my DocumentDB repository, and it's a particular type of item. And I now have this thing that I've built here called a partition resolver, okay? And let me show you what the partition resolver looks like. And this is how I'm telling my system I'm going to partition, all right? Again, I've got an interface over here that says two main methods. One is for resolve for create and one is resolve for read, okay? Resolve for read says I'm trying to read a document. Based on the partition strategy that you're going to use, tell me which collection or collections I should go and look from, okay? And that's why it's returning an enumerable string, because depending on my partition strategy, the record I'm looking for may actually be in more than one collection. So I have to do a fanout query and go and fetch it for you. This one over here says, hey, go and resolve the collection for write. So here I've got a document, I'm trying to write it. Tell me where I should go write it to, okay? And that's basically what the interface does. And now you'll see I've created a lookup partition. I'll get back to what these classes are in a bit. But basically, I've created a lookup partition which implements my partition resolver, okay? Here I've got my master collection link. Now, anybody who's worked with DocumentDB before has seen this concept of a self-link, okay? We haven't spoken about it yet, but a self-link is basically a static, RESTful, addressable URI for a resource. So here I've got my databases. That's the database's resource ID, okay? Then a database has collections, and that's the collection's resource ID, okay? So using that URI, I can get to that collection directly, okay? So what I've actually done is, rather than keeping the collection's ID, the human readable ID, because then I'd have to go and write some code to look that collection up and get it, I actually just store that value in config instead of storing the human readable one, right? Now I can actually use that without writing a bunch of boilerplate code to go and look up the database and get the collection and all of that kind of stuff, just to get the self-link, okay? So go create your collection, look up what its self-link is, and then just store what the self-link is, right? So let me show you quickly over here what that looks like. So if I go to DocDB accounts and I go to my document database and I jump across to Document Explorer, and I go to my sharding demo, and in my master collection, I have one document at the moment called the shard map, right? And in the shard map, you can see this is what my shard map looks like, okay? So in short, it's a map of tenants to collections. There's a tenant's name, and that tenant has a couple of collections. So in this case, you can see Contoso Inc. Started out with that collection name, okay? It's not the currently active collection for that one. This one here is the currently active collection for Contoso, okay? Litware is in that collection, AdventureWorks is in that collection, right? And that's what my shard map looks like. Now, if I jump back to Visual Studio, that's what these internal classes represent, okay? They're the .NET representation of that shard map. So that I can go do things later, I'll show you where I can actually write cool link queries against the shard map that comes back. So I can actually query my shard map using link. So effectively, all that happens is right over here, you'll see there's the resolve for create method. Okay, so every time I try and query something, so if I have a look in my item repository, okay, and I go to the create method over there says, given an item, okay, and a tenant ID, go talk to the partition resolver, resolve for create, so tell me where I should create this thing, okay, and you see I get back a collection link, all right, and then all I'm going to do is set the tenant ID on it to make sure every document's got a tenant ID, and then I'm going to run the generic create method, and that's it, okay. So my application, when my application wants to create a document, it doesn't care about collections, okay. It just says, hey, database, go and put this thing in here, and here's the tenant ID. And my repository goes and figures out which repository to load and figures, and the repository partition resolver figures out which collection or collections to go and work with. So if I open up a small little unit test project, okay, there's my service endpoint, my auth key, those keys that were important. And now that I've shown the world my key, I need to remember to rotate my key, which I always forget to do. So my key's always out there in the wild somewhere. But basically, I've got a little method here that says can write to DB, okay? And all that's going to do is Contoso Inc., create a document, repository, and then go and create it, okay? That's it, repo.create, okay? You can see nowhere do I say, hey, go create it in this collection or whatever. The repository takes care of all of that for me, all right? So if I go and run this now, so let's go and kind of do a simple debug through this little test quickly, right? So it's just newing up my document. Okay, there I have my document. Okay, you can see it's just my document. Okay, here I'm gonna go new up my repository. So I'm actually telling my my repository which partition resolver I'm using, okay? So it's gonna go new that up, and then I'm just gonna initialize it. And what the initialize does is it goes and loads my shard map, all right? So into load shard map says, hey, go get me the document ID shard map, okay? And if I run that, there you'll see my shard map is now fully loaded up, okay? And I can now actually go and query that shard map in stuff. So there you go, it's loaded up the shard map. I'm caching that up here, in my case, just in a simple kind of static thing, okay? So that I've loaded it once and I use it again. So once I've done that, it says, all right, repository, hey, here's an item and a tenant. The first thing I want you to do is go and resolve for create, right? So it jumps into here, it then says that's my tenant ID, and it runs a simple link query against my shard map that says, given tenant collections in the shard map, okay, using the collection links, get me where the partition key matches the tenant, okay, and the collection link is the active collection link, all right? Because I only want to put records into the active collection for that tenant. And in case there were more than one, active collection, you shouldn't probably have more than one, but in case there were more than one, you see each collection also has when did I create this entry in the map for that tenant. So now I'm descending, I'm ordering by that date mapped in descending order, and then I'm selecting a single record out of there. Okay, so give me one collection that I should go and put something into. And if I run that for this particular one, there you can see it's come back with a collection self link, right? And that's all my repository needs. It just needs that collection link. And it then goes and says, hey, go and do that. And now base, go and create with that collection link, go create me that item. And what's the item's ID? Do something awesome. Okay, so if I go and run that, it will go and run, do something awesome. And my test is run. If I come back here now and I go to, let's go and have a look. There's some documents here, okay? And if I go and have a look, do something awesome for Contoso Inc., you can see I've run this a couple of times, but you'll see that it's put it in collection one. If I go and look in collection two, you'll see it's also got documents, but the documents are for AdventureWorks, Litware Inc., you know, so these are different tenants' documents have set in a different collection. And if I go to collection three, this is actually where I would have created it because this is the one that's currently active for Contoso. And if you want to have a look, that was created right now in GMT time. Okay, so that was the document I just went ahead and created. And that's a simple lookup-based kind of partition resolver. So nothing complicated at all, just a nice segregation of repository using a partition resolver, and the partition resolver and the repository work together to figure out where it should go and do some stuff. The same thing happens if I look at the unit test and I go look at canRead. CanRead obviously now goes, it just creates a document, and then it goes, hey, repository, given this tenant ID, go and find me a document, so some predicate, and then I just want the first or default. Now, if I go to the repository's find method, okay, the repository says to the partition resolver, hey, go and instead of resolve for create, this time go and resolve for read, all right? And resolve for read says something that looks like this, says, hey, a very similar kind of one to that, except this time I'm not pulling out a single because there could be more. I'm just saying, give me all collections for this tenant, okay? And return it in an enumerable of string. And then you'll see what my repository does is my repository actually then does select many, so it pulls out all the collection links, okay? And what then happens over here in the find method, okay, that find method actually then runs, if I go back out, sorry, okay, it runs base.find for every single one of those collections. So if there were three collections that came back, it'll run base.find three times, and it'll actually aggregate the results together, and it'll give you back one list. So that's what the select mini does. The select mini will go and run that operation for each collection link that the partition resolver gave back. It'll run that base function over there with the predicate. And that's it. And that's a simple kind of lookup-based sharding strategy. So if we jump back to this one and take a look at some of the others, the other favorite one that we see a lot is this concept of partitioning by hash, right? So I have some kind of an algorithm that figures out what collection I should be in. And there are different hashing algorithms. There's a normal hash, there's a modular hash, there's a consistent hashing algorithm. There's a number of these different well-known hashing algorithms. So if you want, go have a look online, go to your favorite search engine, type C# consistent hash algorithm, and you'll actually find an open source hash algorithm, so you can just grab it and use it.
So one common thing that we've seen, at least within NoSQL, is a consistent hash ring based on Murmur hash.
Yeah, based on Murmur hash, consistent hash rings. Yeah,
and that gives you the nice options of being able to rebalance when you need, as well as have the uniform distribution.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is what.
Yeah, and I think I've got a simple sample here of just modular based hashing. Modular-based hashing gives you that nice kind of even distribution across your collections, but it's a little bit harder when you want to start rebalancing and you're wanting to take a node out of the ring or put a node into the ring, and that's where consistent hashing is much, much better. So basically, the idea is that the algorithm tells your application where to go and write. Okay, so, and then what you can always do is you can always add new collections, and your algorithm now starts using that. You can take a collection away, and your algorithm stops sending to that collection. So jumping back to code, I have another example over here of a simple hashing algorithm. So let's take a look at this one quickly. This one, again, is a very, very similar structure, so I'm not going to go through that. In fact, I'm using the same model, the same structure over here with repositories and partition resolvers, except this time over here I've got a hash partition resolver. And you'll see this one doesn't have the concept of a shard key or a shard map or any of that kind of stuff. It's got some other logic. So if I take a look at its logic, you can come down and you see here I'm maintaining a list of my partitions. Okay, and just for purposes of this demo, what I've done is I've actually just said, hey, these are the two collections I've got. All right. You probably wouldn't do this in a real application, but just for purposes of demos, I've said these are my two collections. All right. And I want you to hash evenly across those two collections. And here you'll see I'm using the getPartition index method. This is using my Murmur hash sample, okay, that you were talking about. And it uses, it does a hash of my partition key and then projects that hash into using Murmur hash and does a mod of the bytes to the partition count. Okay, and that means I will get a random even distribution across those two. If I had three collections in here, it would then evenly distribute across three. If I had four, it would evenly distribute across four, right? And I'm not going to walk you through the Murmur hash stuff, but this is just pulled straight off the web There is very well documented MemoHash algorithms. All right. So in this case, the repository does exactly the same thing. So you can go to item repository here, and you can see this time it does resolve for read and resolve for create exactly the same way again. If I go resolve for read and I go to its definition, you'll see this time I do things like here, I'm saying, hey, I've given you a partition key, so resolve that to an index, okay? And I'm using that get partition index, which uses the MoMA function, okay? And if you go and have a look at the resolve for create, again, I'm saying figure out what partition index I should be in, get me that single partition, and let me write and create my data. So if you go across to my database again and switch to a different database this time, hash sharding, you'll see I've got two collections over here. First collection has got three documents in it, all right? And it's Litware Inc. and Contoso Inc. are sharing this first collection. And if I have a look at the second collection, you'll probably see AdventureWorks is on his own in this one. So using this tenant ID, AdventureWorks always resolves to this collection. Using Litware Inc. or Contoso always resolves to the first collection, all right? And it's exactly the same logic in the application. If I go and have a look at the test case, and I run my test case over here, can write to database, you'll see I'm creating one document for Contoso Inc., one document for Litware Inc., one document for AdventureWorks, all right? And again, all I'm doing is I'm saying, hey, repository, here's an, given this client and this database, here's a document, here's a tenant, go and write it. Okay, I don't care where you write it, just go and write it. And when I read it, again, all I'm doing is I'm saying down here, all I'm saying is go find me that document. Okay, I'm giving you the tenant, I'm giving you some predicate, go find me where that document is. Okay, so if I write this, now you'll see Contoso Inc. over here. Let me go and run this one, and you'll see that this guy over here, goes in here. The first thing that it's going to do is it's going to resolve for create. So step into the resolve for create, comes along and it says, get me the partition index. So it comes in here and this is where I'm going to use that. So there's the bytes. Okay. And now using that bytes modded by the count of my partitions, it comes out with partition index zero, right? And that's what I'm doing. I'm returning the partition index zero. Resolved for partition is the first one in that list. Therefore, hey, repository, when you want to go write this thing, go put it into that collection, write it, and you'll see it'll now do the write. The find actually comes back, you'll see there is only one collection, so it ran that, and the document that's come back has been found in that repository. So again, an application that is scaled out and partitioned across multiple collections, but the application itself, you know, there's no logic to go figure that out. That logic is just sitting in a nicely contained, wrapped up kind of repository. So that's how to do simple hash partitioning. And like I said, there's lots and lots and lots of different ways. There's also lots of different strategies. You may decide to do hash with lookup with spillover, right? So I may want to evenly distribute across a set of collections for 7 days. And if a collection falls up before the 7 days is up, spillover to a second one. Right, so take those three strategies that I've just talked about and combine a custom partitioning strategy that uses all three of them. Okay. In which case, you would just go into the sample code that I wrote, define yourself a new partition resolver that had that logic in it, okay, potentially extending the other two that I had, and then your application would have its own way of sharding. Okay. The nice thing is that, again, your application becomes abstracted from that. So if at a later stage you decide to change your partitioning strategy, you could go into your repository layer, change the partitioning strategy that it uses, and your application would just kind of keep working, right? It wouldn't really know, because it doesn't understand the concept of a collection. It just understands the partition key, the database, and the items that it's reading and writing. That's it.
And on top of that, by controlling it in your application layer, you can still keep some of the guarantees like stored procedure execution,
yeah,
by making sure your requests just target the collections, only the collections that you need.
Absolutely.
You can have a little bit of the best of both worlds.
Yeah, that's great. Fan-out query, there was the notion, and I think you saw it, where in my resolvers they do the notion of resolve for read wasn't just a single collection that came back. There was a list of collections. And what my resolver what my repo does in the select many and then it projects into a clause is effectively doing a fan-out query, right? Now, this one is doing them sequentially, synchronously, so it'll do one query, then the next query, then the next query, then the next query. You can actually take that and you can even extend it further in .NET and execute parallel queries, right? So if your resolver came back and said, hey, here's three different collections where the record could be in based on your partitioning strategy, you could in .NET fire all three of those queries off in parallel, sit back, wait for the responses to come back from all three of them, then aggregate the results and produce that back to the application. For the simple demo that I did, I was just doing sequential synchronous kind of queries, but you can absolutely do parallel query execution on different threads if you wanted to. But you know, it's not that bad. And people look at me and say, "Oh, but this is multiple round trips to the server, and you know all that kind of stuff." Remember, if your web application or your application is sitting in Azure, in the West US data center, and your DocumentDB account is sitting in the West US data center, you've got sub millisecond round trip time. And if I'm firing off five queries in parallel, that's sub millisecond kind of response time for five queries to run. You know, it's really not a big deal to do this, and it actually works, you know, quite efficiently. And DocumentDB is well designed and suited to this kind of thing. So that's what a fan out query is. But you'll find if you do it with the repository kind of pattern with a resolver like I've done, then that repo takes care of the fan outs for you. So the application doesn't go, oh, let me make this query, let me make that query. The repository just fans out and does all the queries for you. So in summary, you know, again, just in case you don't know, a collection is equal to a shard or a partition. Okay, so think about what data goes into a collection. Think about how you're going to do that. Think about what you keep together. There are many, many, many different ways to partition the data. I can't tell you, Arvin, partition your data like this. Joe, partition your data like that. Because it depends on your workload. It depends on how you plan on partitioning. It depends on your application. It depends on volume of data, your write patterns, your read patterns, all of that kind of stuff. So you really do need to understand your application and then build a partitioning strategy for that. The nice thing is that you can start off with a partitioning strategy and then you can evolve your application as you go, right? And that's one of the benefits of a schemaless kind of database, is that it makes it easier to kind of drive these innovations as you go. And then I mentioned the single tenant, multi-tenant kind of concept. So a lot of people, when they first come into to DocumentDB and they're building these applications, they want to, the temptation is always, hey, I want to put each tenant in a database on their own for tenant isolation, right? And there are some actually very good reasons for doing tenant isolation, and we can have a discussion about that. But for the most part, you'll get better economies of scale if you densely pack your tenants into multiple tenants into a single collection. And that's what the image on the right-hand side is actually showing, is how I multi or densely pack tenants into collections together. And that's it. That's the end of the session on sharding. That also brings us to the end of the first session of developing solutions with DocumentDB. We're now going to take a hour-long meal break, and we will see you back for the remaining three modules after that. Thank you.